Welcome to Main Street on this Wednesday here in North Dakota. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we are happy that you are with us today. Coming up in the second half of today's show, Chef Candace Stock stops by the Main Street studio and joins Rick Guillon for another edition of Prairie Plates. She's leading a special community meal tomorrow here in Fargo with Chef Joe Swaygarden, featuring a pay-what-you-can indigenous menu that highlights tradition, sustainability, and cultural storytelling. And another segment from the live event, The Tell. This time, Beth Renner is the teller. And we begin Main Street today with Kate Keene. She's the Area Vice President of Global Cyber Advocacy at Worldwide Technologies. She brings over 25 years of experience in cybersecurity, technology, and AI strategies. Kate, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks for having me, Craig. I appreciate being here.
All right. So one of my family members yesterday received this email. I'll read a summary to protect the not so innocent. A recent security incident has impacted our organization. While the full extent of the breach is unclear, potentially affected information includes health insurance and medical data, billing and payment details, and personal identifiers such as social security and driver's license numbers. Employees enrolled in the program will receive a letter or email in the coming days with further details. Those affected will be provided with 2 years of free credit monitoring. And the company said, now I quote, they have also promised to make the necessary changes so that this does not happen in the future. Kate, it makes me ask this question. They just learned yesterday what to do to prevent this, or they were just dragging their feet because why?
You know, when we talk about cyber attack, you know, and breaches that we hear about today, you know, the letter you mentioned, you know, protecting the innocent is one that I think all of us have gotten. The reality is that, you know, cyber attacks, there's over 4,000 a day now, one every 19 seconds. And so for organizations trying to keep up with, you know, proper security and doing the things necessary, and I can go through a whole list, it's not only a full-time job, it's the job of sometimes thousands of people in an organization. But the reality is that every company out there could spend every dollar they make on cyber and still may not be safe. We see really three types of attacks. You have malicious, you know, where it's a group that comes in to do harm or, you know, cause disruption or financial gain. You have mistake, where a system goes down, something happens, you know, and it brings things offline, like we saw this summer. And you now have malfunction, where we see AI networks that can hallucinate, LLMs that do something odd. And so trying to keep up with all of it is just almost untenable, and it's a reality of the technical world we live in today that we are going to have breach.
So back to my question, this very real company who is in the Midwest, near where we live here in North Dakota, is it companies like those guys who are balancing, okay, I've got X amount of resources, I can only do so much, but now I'm hurt by this, I've got to do more, or they just didn't want to do more and thought they could slip by?
It's not a question of doing more or slipping by. I always say that the best of intentions pave the road to hell. And it's a question of, we can get the basics right. We can do things like creating data backups, encrypting sensitive information, updating security systems and patching, conducting cybersecurity training, leveraging strong identity access. And there'll be a new vulnerability. There'll be something in the supply chain. You know, something will happen that wasn't anticipated. And so it's a question of continually looking and monitoring what activity is potentially malicious to your organization and then creating a response. And unfortunately, sometimes those responses just aren't fast enough to keep up with the threat actors.
Okay, so let's get into the list. Let's start with companies first. You have a whole array of things that companies should do. Dumb it down for me so we can understand what it is you're telling us that we should suggest, but here we go.
So the first thing is, you know, every organization should be aware of subscribing to some type of threat intelligence, which there's lots of different things, but understanding really, you know, from a layman's perspective, who or what types of groups, you know, from either being hacktivists, those are groups that are trying to create some type of a political message, criminal, you know, we see them wanting, you know, ransomware, and we all hear about the attacks that, you know, the ransomware attacks that cost millions and millions and millions of dollars in payment in Bitcoin. Or you're talking about nation state activity, you know, or just somebody that's got a grudge, you know, insider threat. So understanding what groups may find your businesses appealing and why. The second thing is really having organizations understand their critical business functions. What does it take to have a minimum viable business? So to give you an example, you know, if you are a healthcare provider, like you were talking about, you know, payment systems, being able to access hospital records, you know, making sure systems stay on when patients are attached to them, those kinds of things. What are your critical functions and how do we make sure those are secured first? The third piece is when you understand that, so you know who is going to attack you, what they might attack, and what would it do to your business, it's then a question of creating what we call a cyber resilience strategy. And there's three parts to that. The first part is operational resilience. What is it going to take to keep the lights on? So what are the base security measures, what we call hygiene, that are going to help you keep those lights on? And then test it, educate about it, do all the things like we would for any other type of preparedness. The second piece is financial transfer. So understanding your options from a cyber insurance perspective, what things could go down and what could you financially tolerate? You know, if you have a backup system and maybe, you know, records wouldn't be available for a day, but critical things would, what does that look like? What's the financial impact? And then the third piece is recovery and restoration. When something does go wrong, how fast can you bring in trusted advisors and partners to help you understand what's going on and how to bring the systems back up? That's the most critical thing, is having a holistic strategy around all of it. And then also, ironically, which a lot of companies forget, a good communication plan.
I'm guessing you should have those relationships in place, not just reached out to the recovery and restoration folks when, something's happened, right?
100%.
You'll have to pay for those, though.
Yep, you do. Having trusted partners in security is probably the most important things. Understand who are companies and partners like mine, you know, honestly, that you can trust to help you build solutions, test solutions, recover solutions, so that when things go wrong, you know who you're going to call.
I think also it's interesting that some companies I'm familiar with, we've got the backup strategies. We know what to do. Have you done it? Well, no, we haven't. That step, because we have the backups, we have every, and I've seen that more than once.
I always talk about cyber from a maturity curve perspective, and I call that the false confidence. You know, I remember once walking into a large distribution organization, and the CISO said, "Kate, can you come in and take a look? You know, I'm coming in after my predecessor," and they bought $10 million worth of boxes, pretty much everything off of a security showroom floor, and he's like, "I have all of this. What do I do with it?" And that's the thing, you know, we can protect ourselves up the hill, but if you don't actually enact and test what you have, it's really hard to understand how you perform under fire.
So my son was going down a road where they needed to make a decision about their billing systems in their practice. Okay. And so they had a system with local servers in-house, and the option was to go to the cloud. And my basic intelligence for him was move it to the cloud, because then somebody else is supposedly taking care of all of this, but you got to ask. You've got to ask questions about how is it that they plan to recover from a breach of some sort. What questions should he be asking?
So what you're talking about is a common term in cyber called third-party risk. And so it's a question of leveraging someone else or having somebody in your supply chain that's taking some of your security, in essence, posture. The questions you want to ask, you know, are kind of the same that you'd ask of yourself, is what does their security maturity score look like? You know, what international standards or national standards are they standing up to? Things like, I'll use some technical terms, but SOC 2, NIST, those kinds of things. Also, are they willing to do security assessments with you? You know, where you can where you bring in your partners like your cloud providers and have a full assessment of your holistic environment, including your third-party risk providers, your critical, you know, supply chain providers, to ensure that if they get hit, you understand how you'll respond. We saw that with some of the healthcare breaches last year where, you know, it wasn't necessarily the hospital system that had an issue. It was the billing system or it was the payment system and what that did to cripple the other organizations. So understanding your dependencies, like you were just talking about with the cloud providers and how they're approaching holistic security, and asking those questions of not necessarily what are you doing, but how are you going to help me if you impact me? And what that looks like, you know, being a bit more focused on selfishly your own internal versus their external.
Yeah, if you're not selfish about it, nobody else is going to be, right?
Yep, you got to look out for number one.
Joining my conversation with Kate Keene, she's the Area Vice President of Global Cyber Advocacy at Worldwide Technology, and she brings over 25 years of experience in cybersecurity, technology, and AI. Kate, I read a statistic that 66% of organizations were impacted or affected by ransomware in 2023. A, is it really that high? And B, how can one protect themselves from ransomware attacks?
So it really is that high, to be honest with you.
That's stunning.
I mean, think about it. There, like I was saying earlier, there's a cyber attack every 19 seconds globally. So, you know, just do the math on it. It's everywhere. Ransomware is one of those things where, you know, it's how they get in and then what they do when they get in. So with ransomware, they're trying to either steal data that they can use to extort money, or they're going to basically blow up data or hold data hostage or hold your environment hostage until you pay. So the critical thing with ransomware is, again, good, strong identity access management, understanding what we call zero trust, how you can look at micro-segmentation, really helping your industry and your company look at how do you give people access only to data they need at the time they need it. That's one of the most critical things. Education, though, you know, as far as not clicking on the emails from the Nigerian prince, looking and doing phishing simulations, understanding and helping your employees understand their role with how ransomware could propagate. You know, scary story is I was chatting not long ago with the wife of a company that was a concrete distributor, not necessarily an organization you would expect to see ransomware.
Glitzy and Glamourly, yeah, they sell concrete, right?
They sell concrete. Why would that be a concern? And the CEO of the company decided to send an email from his wife's phone, didn't realize the phone was infected, ransomware got in. It was a $2 million ransom from a Turkish gang. $2 million from an email off his wife's phone into his environment. So understanding how you leverage technology and what it's connected to in your back office systems, and making sure your employees are aware of your processes and policies around using third-party devices, personal devices, things like that. Those are critical things when looking at how you approach ransomware.
Every day I could whip out my credit card and fill out some form online and buy something from somebody. What should I be looking for? I mean, I want to make sure that I have the little lock on my browser that says I'm at least visiting over an encrypted link on my internet, the thing that starts with HTTPS for those that aren't sure what that means, at least that. But after that, what else should we do? We're kind of throwing stuff out there.
Yeah, I mean, the credit card issue is always a big one. And so there's a couple of things, you know, so we see a couple of things within credit card fraud and within really what we call, you know, financial criminal law at this point is where we're headed with that. The first thing is make sure you're using trusted sites. So, you know, if you're going to pay something over a credit card, make sure that you, one, are using a trusted browser, like you were just talking about HTTPS. Two, a lot of credit card companies offer basically verification where you can have a two-party authentication where if you're going to use the number, you know, there is a code that comes to your phone and that's put in before the transaction goes through to make sure it's from you. Third is, you know, if you're going to use your credit card on, you know, sites, you may want to consider having a low limit credit card or only one that you use for online purchases. Because there are things like data scrapers that are looking for credit card numbers. There are spoofs that'll come in and attach to your browser to watch for sensitive financial data. And so, you know, really having good health and hygiene around how you're using your credit card, both online and actually in retail. You know, it's interesting, but we see a lot of scams where, you know, a small device is put into your gas station and takes your credit card number, and then it's used again. So monitoring your activity, monitoring how you're using it, thinking about only having one that has a low limit, you know, so that if something does happen, it doesn't skyrocket out. Those are really good practices.
I can have my credit card in my wallet, pull it out and tap, or I can use my phone and tap. Where am I safer?
They're about the same, I'll be honest with you, to be dead serious. I'll tell you, as a mom of five, I like the phone better, and the reason is because I can monitor what my kids are doing when they're tapping on their phone and they're attached to my accounts. I can see everybody's activity, which is kind of nice. And attached to their online profiles. So for me, the phone is a safer one. But, you know, from a security perspective, it's about the same. The other thing is, you know, if somebody's looking to get your data and they have, you know, a scanner or something, you know, that they can actually walk past you and grab the information straight out of your wallet if you don't have, you know, an RFID wallet and those kinds of things. There's a million different ways. The sad part is
RFID wallets really work and they're important.
They are, if you're going to, you know, if you think
that. I always thought that was a 1-800 buy me now scam.
No, my husband actually swears by him. I'm not quite as sure, but he does swear by him. He's in security as well. What I would say, though, is if somebody is really going to target your information or try and get at it, they're going to probably get it. So it's a question of safeguarding, like I said, how your activity is being looked at, what you're doing, where you're using things, you know, is really critical.
What about platforms that we all use? We all use Gmail. We all use Outlook. Are there things that we should do to enhance our security just using those systems? And I'm thinking when I go to the coffee shop, pop open the laptop, and I go to town. I may be using a VPN. You can talk about those, Kate, if you want to, for just a moment. Or I may be in a hurry and nobody's around. So am I being silly there?
So VPN, for those that don't know, we're talking about virtual private networks. And what I would say is, again, think about what you're doing. If you're just surfing your Starbucks app to see how many points you have and whether or not you're going to get a free latte, I'm not as concerned about looking at the data, to be honest with you. If I'm sitting in my Starbucks writing a comprehensive financial report that has competitive data in it, guess what? My company's not going to be super happy that I'm sitting there doing sensitive work on an open network, and they're going to probably want me on a VPN. You know, you have to think about what you're doing. As you know, when we talk about Gmail and we use our own things, there's kind of two sides to it. One, if you are leveraging Gmail or, you know, a personal type of an email platform for anything that has sensitive data, you know, data about potentially customers, let's say you have an online business, you know, or you're putting your banking information or whatever else, if you're putting that through your personal email, there are advanced email settings that, you know, Gmail and the other carriers have that you can turn on. Make sure they're on. Think about the data you're sending. Think about what you're accessing. And if it's something you wouldn't want someone to see or have access to, then take steps like installing virtual private networks, advanced email systems, you know, those kinds of things. Just take that extra step. Just like when you leave the house, you don't leave the door open and the alarm system off. Same kind of a thing. You know, take the extra steps, turn on the, you know, advanced email system, make sure you go over a VPN that you would in your personal life in other areas.
I have a couple different workstations where I work. I'm at one of them now. It happens to be a Windows box. The one upstairs and around the corner is a Linux box. Am I fooling myself thinking that I'm safer on the Linux box than I am on the Windows box?
Oh, the old Linux versus Windows question. Craig, you're going to make me go on the record on what I like better. I don't know if I can do that. Here's the thing. The average consumer, the average person that's listening to you is going to go, Linux what?
It's a different operating system that operates on computers, much like Windows, but it isn't Windows. There you go.
There you go. But it's still, to this day, not quite as popular on mainstream. And you and I both know that. The reality is that both are safe. Both also have vulnerabilities. I would not say one way or another one is safer. It's a question of how are you leveraging it and what are you leveraging in it? That's the most important thing. So, you know, I'm going to sidestep the Linux versus Windows question. And what I'm going to say is, all operating systems have vulnerabilities. All operating systems have capabilities from a cyber perspective. It's how you use things that's really important.
You mentioned AI just a little bit ago in our interview, Kate, and I'm worried about it because now it can essentially go out there and try everything sooner rather than later to get at me. Is that a threat that I ought to be worried about and think about?
Yeah, it is. I mean, so here's the critical thing. AI, a lot of people forget, has been around for 70 years since the Alan Turing test, 70 years old. There's, you know, four real types from an AI perspective that we look at, but the one that we're talking about a lot today is agentic and general and generative AI. We haven't yet gotten to general AI, which is true mimicking of human cognition, but it's coming fast. The reality is AI is going to be the greatest innovation of this century, and it's also the biggest threat. The reality is that attackers, hackers can now leverage basically AI to create attacks and things that mimic what we do as humans. we're gathering lots of information. I just saw a very scary statistic that 50% of all social media sites are some type of AI generated bot at this moment to gather information. Think about that, 50%, one in two. So it's a question of, while AI will transform how we, you know, how we work, but the other side of the fence is that same AI is creating attacks in my Gmail, like we talked about, or on web browsers or in social media to try and get more information so that I can be attacked and hacked and my data is stolen. It's just both sides of the fence. It's going to change. And what I mean by that is we will always, the reality is we live in a digital world. We will no longer know a world where technology does not impact every area that we live in. You know, you and I are both of an age where we remember rotary phones and, you know, where a TV had a couple of stations and a computer had a green screen and you kind of played around with it, but it wasn't a big thing. You know, I have a three-year-old who lives on a screen, will never know a world without AI. And the idea that a phone would be connected to something in the wall and doesn't get carried with him is a totally foreign concept. So as the world changes, the threat actors change, how they approach us. You know, there's been criminals in our world our entire life.
Right.
It's how they attack us and how they try and benefit from technology that will continue to change. So it's not getting worse or better. It's just reacting to our dependency on technology today.
As we kind of wrap things up, Kate, had this discussion with some friends relative to some undocumented commands that were found in a Bluetooth chip used by a billion devices. We've just bought a new vehicle. It is collecting data left and right all the time. I don't know where it's going, but I don't have control over any of that. Are there things we should do before we buy stuff or do stuff? They get to have my data because there's nothing I can do about it, nor do I even know what they're taking.
Data at this point is one of our biggest assets and biggest commodities. So understanding how companies are going to use it, being active in personal use, you know, so we think about this concept of data privacy. And if you're comfortable with data being shared, you know, the car example you gave is a great one. You know, you have the right to opt in or opt out of, like, my Honda Odyssey has my Odyssey. And so, you know, it asks me all the time, can I share data with Honda? And I can say no. You know, we have the right to say no.
But we want to make our product better, Kate.
I know, but you know what? I'm not comfortable with that. So I get to say no. You know, so understanding acceptable use. The reality, though, is we are not going to go back to an age of, you know, no technology, no chips, and there are going to be infiltrations. So again, protecting your personal data. And when you think about, like, you know, the gone are the days of, you know, something that doesn't collect anything. It's a question of making sure you understand what they're collecting and are you comfortable with it? And if you don't, remembering you have the right to say no.
I just went into a grocery store yesterday, and for the first time, we've all seen those little signs, you're being recorded. And the assumption there is my video is being recorded. But this sign said, we are recording audio. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. Okay, now they're going to know what I sound like, what my inflections are. Interesting. And again, if I want to shop in their store, there's not a lot I can do about that.
That's the thing. There was a great statement by one of my mentors, Vint Cerf, who was one of the gentlemen that created TCP/IP and is now the internet evangelist to Google. And he said, privacy is extinct. And I tend to agree with him that privacy is extinct. So, you know, it's, again, being aware that your image, your likeness, your voice, I'm blessed enough to work with an amazing group of engineers. And one of their favorite things to do is deepfake me. I'm either retiring to go to koala shedding season or AI impersonations of Kate are going to, you know, rule the world. There's always some new video of something they've taken from me, you know, online. I'm sure this recording will get something. It'll be great. And so remembering that everywhere you go, there is now a documentation of it. And there is no place where you're not, in essence, being watched on some level.
Should I ask you this question as we say goodbye, Kate? Have you ever been hacked?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Me too. My guest today has been Kate Keene. She's the Area Vice President of Global Cyber Advocacy at Worldwide Technologies. She has over 25 years of experience in cybersecurity technology and AI strategies. Kate, it has been a pleasure. Thanks for taking time today and joining us on Main Street.
Thank you so much, Craig. Appreciate it.
Still ahead on Main Street, Rick Guillon joins me in the Main Street studio with our special guest, Chef Candace Stock, plus another segment from The Tell. That's all ahead today on Main Street, right after this.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
need some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
There's the music that tells us it's Wednesday and time for another edition of Prairie Plates. Rick Gion joins us in the Main Street studio with a special guest, Chef Candace Stock. First, Rick, welcome back to Main Street.
It's good to be back with you, Craig. We're getting close to St. Patrick's Day, so I'm thinking about corned beef and cabbage.
Seeing green already, even though we're going to get some of the white stuff here in a couple of days. Candace, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
Candace, I want to start with a special event that you are hosting tomorrow, and it's hosted at the Indigenous Association, which is at 720 First Avenue in North Fargo. What is the event, Candace, and what do you hope happens?
So we're partnering with Heart and Soul Cafe and just providing a low-cost, pay-what-you-can meal to the community. But for the Indigenous Association, it's really important for us to stay represented in the community and just bring people in to see, you know, who we are. And I think as leaders in the community, the most important thing we can do is continuously gift our community with what our land can provide and connections. And so the meal itself is focused on the March moon, this Bakedoke Gizis, and it's like the maple syrup moon. So coming into this season where everything's defrosting and you get like just that first hint of green and the trees produce sap, everything in the menu that we're going to be having has that element of light sweetness. And it's really just to like fuel you for the upcoming season.
You'll be working with Chef Joe Swaygarden, who's been with us too here on Prairie Plates. What will the menu consist of, Candace?
So every meal I prepare, I like to incorporate the Three Sisters. And that was actually Joe's idea also, which was great. But it's squash and corn and beans. And those three ingredients are huge staples, but also deities in Native culture. And they are what get us through the hardest time of year. And so just honoring those ingredients is really important. So we have the Three Sisters salad, and we have beautiful white kidney beans that were donated from Doubting Thomas Farms, hominy corn, and a really bright, tangy sumac dressing. And then Joe actually proposed making kunuchi, which my background is a little bit more diverse. My family's from the Ho-Chunk Winnebago tribe, but I'm also Choctaw, Pawnee, and Cree. And so southern tribes make kunuchi, and it is typically made with hickory nuts, and you boil them shell on and then puree it and serve roasted squash on top. We try to stay a little bit more regional, so we're using hazelnuts that grow better in the northern climates. And then I like to include game meat, and so we're doing just skewers of bison and elk with chimichurri sauce, and that'll be served over wild rice that was harvested from the otter tail, and a light cornbread, and then to finish off, a Mother Hubbard squash cake, which is, I mean, like a staple in my family. Like my grandma always made it, and it has just a beautiful floral, nutty sweetness to it. Blueberry wajepe and an oat and walnut crumble will also be paired with the cake.
It sounds awfully tasty, doesn't it, Rick?
It does. I'll definitely be attending this event, and it's at the Indigenous Association, which is located at 720 First Avenue North in downtown Fargo. It's right above the education spaces at the Plains Art Museum. Just wanted to make sure people know, because the kitchen they're preparing it in is at First Presbyterian, which isn't too far away, but the dinner is at the Indigenous Association, so come up there. It's pay what you can, which is really special. That's a special part about Heart and Soul. My question for Chef Candace is, there's different organizations involved, Heart and Soul, the Indigenous Association, and the International Potluck, the FM International Potluck. And we haven't had Peter on yet, but we will. And those potlucks are very special. The last one was at Concordia, and I think 500 or 600 people were there. It was just amazing. Foods represented around the world. What does it mean to you to be associated with this or partnering with these three organizations that do a lot of good food work in the community?
Well, first of all, it's an honor. And I think that for what they're doing, it aligns with, you know, the things that I'm passionate about. Food is an invitation. It's a gift. And so having these events and having these connections with the community, it really allows people to get to know each other and have that first bite and just absorb the cultures. It allows people to be a lot more receptive of other people, understanding. Food is just an incredible gift.
Candace, you are a pro-level forager. What are some of your favorite ingredients to forage in North Dakota? And then, of course, let us know how you incorporate those into your cooking.
So I use a lot of staghorn sumac. And it's kind of one of those ingredients. It's really easy. You kind of have to wait for it. But towards the end of summer, it has this beautiful tang and floral aspect to it. But like chemically, it also is kind of an upper.
It's very so, healthy for you.
Yeah. Really gets, you know, your blood flowing. And people that have it typically, you know, get this kind of high from it almost. But there are a lot of beautiful flowers too. The purple thistle flowers, those are like anti-anxiety medicine. And so there are a lot of ingredients that I'll incorporate into my food that allow people to really let their guard down, but also feel energized and excited. So every meal is very crafted so that afterwards you don't feel tired, you don't feel, you know, sweaty or fatigued. It's supposed to heal and nourish.
Let us know a little bit about what you've been up to lately in Medora. We were talking earlier a little bit about some really exciting things. So yeah, talk about that a little bit.
So I took a contracting position with the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library a few years ago, and it's evolved into me becoming their executive chef. And so our cafe services and catering will be from the Indigenous perspective. Everything will be based in food medicine, and we're building curriculum around ingredients and foraging. We have a lot of amazing people working on starting seeds for the library also. So they're going to be planting more Indigenous species of plants all across the property. And with that, we're sourcing a lot of those items because they're food medicine and incorporating them into our menu. I think it's really important for me to be able to provide that in the cafe and then people go outside and be able to see in the landscape what they're eating.
Candace, are you worried at all? At this scale, it might be difficult for you to source everything that you want to be able to have and present to visitors of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library?
I think that I'm in the sourcing phase now, and what I've found is that there are a lot of incredible Native-owned businesses that are working to do just that, and they're incredibly supportive. And so we have some really great partnerships that are falling into place so that, you know, we're not giving people like mounds of, you know, wild berries or anything like that. But we want them to have the taste. We want them to understand what this land can provide. We live in such a beautiful country, and North Dakota, Minnesota, like this is my home. So I find that showcasing the capacity for what we can provide creates a lot of pride in our land.
You know, Chef Candace brings up an interesting point, Craig. Native American, it's those food products are getting easier to find indigenous food products. And there's a market down in Minneapolis affiliated with Sean Sherman and one of the large markets. And it's a littler stall, but it has a ton of products that you can pick up. And you can actually, there's a shop online.
Yep.
I think you're probably familiar with that. Candace, talk about that a little bit.
So it's the Midtown Global Market. Sean Sherman has the Indigenous Food Lab there, and he is just kind of like a facilitator. So he finds a lot of these growers, makers, foragers, and helps them build their platform to start selling their products.
Yeah, and you can find that online. I'll try to find a link to that, but that's to me, that was really interesting. And he also talks about the fact that food is medicine. I don't really think most people think about food that way, but it really is. I mean, think about it when you're sick and you want to get better and that chicken soup and that sort of thing. But all of these products, these teas, beans, non-GMO, organic, these natural local things are really, really good for you. And so, yeah, I don't know. This segment, I partly wanted to emphasize that too, Craig.
Candace, back to the event that's tomorrow. It starts at 5 o'clock. Is that correct?
Correct.
And for someone who has never experienced a meal prepared by you, when they're done, what do you hope that they take away? And again, I want to remind folks, this is hosted at the Indigenous Association, which is at 720 First Avenue, North Fargo. It's above the Plains Art Museum. So Candace, what do you hope people take away who have never been able to experience what it is you're about to prepare for them?
Just that with every meal that I prepare, there's a cook that trained me when I was a teenager, and he always said, you know, cook like you're cooking for the person you love. And so that is just what I'd like for people to take away from this, is that I love doing this, but it means so much more being able to share it with my community. So however they want to receive that, I just want them to know that I care.
Just getting back to this market, the URL is natifs.org, so natives.org. And you can order these indigenous products from there. It's really an interesting website with some videos with Sean Sherman and certain things like that. So it's really interesting. This is kind of a trend, indigenous foods. And I think Sean has started it. Chef Candace is carrying on this tradition here up in the upper Midwest. So I think this is really neat. And this is a dinner that folks really need to pay attention to. And I'd like to see everyone there. So come on out.
As we wrap this up, we're looking towards late spring and summer. Candace, anything on your radar that you want to let us know about?
I work with Noreen Thomas from Doubting Thomas Farms quite a bit. And so we're facilitating a healing meal out at the farm this year. And I think we're just looking for youth right now that are interested in planting with us and gardening through the season. But we're going to inoculate some a corn seed that we got from White Earth and try to grow some corn mushrooms and create a fun dinner for the community. We also have our Taste of the Valley event that will be in September. And the best way to look out for it is the Doubting Thomas Facebook page, but really connecting more so with our vendors. So I'm going to be partnering with all of our vendors. Some of them are gardeners, beekeepers, some keep goats, but preparing a taste with them, with their products, so people have the chance to engage more with them, because nobody knows their products better than they do. No one's going to be more passionate about it. And so having a little bit more of a connection between the customer and our farmers will be the focus of this event.
Well, Candace, I'm glad you were able to join us in the Main Street studio for this edition of Prairie Plates. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
The event is tomorrow, March 13th, begins at 5 p.m. It's hosted by the Indigenous Association. The address is 720 First Avenue North. Fargo. It's above the Plains Art Museum. Chef Canada Stock is working with Chef Joe Swaygarden to create an indigenous menu, and that will be a pay-as-you-can community meal. Rick, thanks for bringing Candace aboard.
You bet, Craig. It's always good to be with you, and we will talk next week.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra presents Masterworks 4, Bliss, featuring Sonia Bosca Harrison, Saturday, March 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, March 16th at 2 p.m. at NDSU's Festival Concert Hall. Tickets at fmsymphony.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The Tell is a monthly live storytelling event in downtown Fargo. And this teller clearly got the message. Like its inspiration, The Moth, volunteer storytellers whose names are drawn randomly will make you cry, think, feel, and in many cases, as today, laugh. Beth Renner will bring home the theme from the August 2024 show, which shares the name of a Beatles song.
All right, we have another, oh, I'm excited. Beth Renner, if you want to stand and come to the stage. And Beth is going to tell us a story called Spanks Me with an X I'm excited about. So come on over, Beth.
So I set my watch to the yoga setting right now, and my heart rate's at 128, so we'll see how this is going to go. I put my name in the hat, and I said to the guy, God, do not draw my name. Okay, so I grew up in a large family, 8 kids, and I have 4 brothers. But I used to hang out with my brothers all the time, and I, from the early ages, I hated to wear a dress. Okay. So much so that when it would come time to go to church, I would purposely throw myself into the gravel and skin my knees, and they'd be bleeding, and my mom says, well, now you can't wear a dress. And I'm like, first communion, I kid you not, if you saw my first communion photo, you would see me in a blue leisure suit that my mother made for me. She was extremely supportive of this, right? When I was 10 years old, she gave me a football helmet because she was so worried about my face being damaged from my brothers, okay? But what happened, I graduated from college. It was a beautiful family day. I was the first one of the family to graduate from college. My mother and father are sitting there, and she said, I'm so proud of you. And then she says this, I hope you get a job where you have to wear a dress every day to work. And I'm like, are you me? 4 years of college, bust my ass, and this is what you're gonna say to me? So, what do? I choose a job, banking. What do you have to do in banking? You have to wear suits to work every day. And when I went into banking, women wore skirt suits every day, right? So here we go. I choose my profession as having to wear a dress every day. So I go into more responsibilities for work. I end up going to Philadelphia. I travel all over on the East Coast. I go to Philadelphia for a big divisional meeting. Anybody been to Philadelphia? Market Street? Very business oriented. Everybody's marching along in their suits, right? Very serious. I have a big meeting. So I thought to myself, I'm going to do something extra. This is when Spanx first came out. Yep. Control top pantyhose were not enough for me. I needed to put another layer on, and I put Spanx on. But little did I know it's really important to get the order of them right. Gals, you know where I'm going with this, right? Yeah. You put them on in the wrong order, and you're going to have a big problem. I put them on the wrong order because I didn't know, because I hated wearing dresses all the time. So I had to go from my hotel to the office, which was about a quarter of a mile. And I had put on my Spanx first and then my pantyhose. They don't stay up. Pantyhose don't stay up. So I'm marching on Market Street, and all of a sudden I feel something. And I'm like, huh, something's not right. Something's really not right. I'm in my skirt, and I am at the stoplight and I have to get to the other building. And I'm like, it's 50 yards, you can do this. So I start to put my knees a little closer together. And I come to the office for my big divisional meeting and I go up to the gal at the desk. Hey, do you know where the restroom's at? So she points me to the restroom and off I go, just like this. And by this time I'm holding my nylons between my knees. But I still got my Spanx on. Okay. I go into the restroom, take those nylons, throw them in the garbage, and all I was hoping for is that my Spanx and nylons would come together.
Tell is back tomorrow night at the 4x4, which is right above Side Street Bar, with the theme, Just When I Thought I Was Out, They Pull Me Back In. Should be fun if you want to tell a story about yourself or watch brave souls do their thing. Showtime is 7 p.m. and information can be found on the Tell's Facebook page or Instagram.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 12th. In 1914, North Dakota high schools could finally compete for a championship title through an organized tournament. The schools were divided into four regions, and the regional champions faced off for the state title on the eastern side of the state. Fargo High School won that state championship game, earning accolades and honors. They also earned a chance to compete in a multi-state championship game in Illinois, sometimes called the Central States Championship, and other times the Western Championship. The tournament brought top players from the region to face off, and many believed Fargo's boys had a strong chance to take the title. However, there was some confusion over the dates. Instead of taking place at the end of the month, with plenty of time to raise money, the tournament was scheduled earlier. But a plea for help, published in the Fargo Forum on March 10th, paid off. The article explained that the boys needed to raise $175 for railway fare and meals. All other expenses would be covered once they arrived in Evanston, Illinois. The very next day, more than $200 had been raised in just 24 hours. Six players and their coach were ready to represent North Dakota on a bigger stage. The Fargo Forum wrote, "Sending the team to this tournament will be the biggest kind of advertisement for Fargo. If they win, it'll be published far and wide, doing more to boost the city than 10 times the amount of money spent on other forms of advertising. Even better, once the teams were paired for the finals, Fargo High learned they'd get an extra day of rest, since they wouldn't play on the first day of the tournament. Teams from Michigan, Indiana, Iowa, Illinois, and Fargo competed in the tournament. In the end, Fargo did not win first place, but they secured a very respectable fourth. The Evanston, Illinois team took first for the fourth year in a row." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us today. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or you can subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Tomorrow on Main Street, we'll visit with Chris Zimmerman. He's the music director for the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra, and he'll tell us what's ahead for this weekend. Plus, Matt Olean will stop by the Main Street studio with his newest movie review, and we'll review the news with our news director, Dave Thompson. That's all ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.